Welcome back to the latest episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast for athletes before, during and after elite sports. I'm Mark Clement. This podcast is brought to you by EY, Building a Better Working World, and their personal performance program. Alongside me, my co-host, Scott Ward, a retired professional footballer who spent the last 10 years working in athlete welfare, leading to the creation of EY's personal performance plan. And welcome back to the second part of our extended chat with a former three-time Sheffield United, Leeds United, Middlesbrough, Leicester City and England forward Brian Deane, the first ever Premier League goal scorer. And along the way, we're going to hear from Manchester United's former head of performance during the latter part of Sir Alex Ferguson's reign, Tony Strudwick.
And when we talk about modern day kids, and we talked about it, we talk about modern day players, talking to Louis about them there, it was another point that Prince William raised: resilience, mental resilience these days, Brian. Are they as strong as they need to be? Do we need to put a bit more tough love into them?
I think because I've had that journey and I've been able to look back, I don't want anybody to think that, you know, this is a book situation. But when you talk about resilience, you know, we're talking about when you're 9 years old, having to go and catch the bus, find the bus to go to a trial. You know, these are all things, you know, being rejected, you know, going on the bus to trials. I can mention any names, just one, let's just say a Tony Adams or whoever, you know, probably working class background, dad's out working, mum's a nurse maybe, has to go to the trials on his own, gets on the bus after school, gets to training. These are all characteristics that make you want to make it. You're only doing that because you want to make it. It's difficult to say how you can make a character more robust, because even if you try, if you've got old school coaches who try and come across quite tough, it's termed as bullying now. Yeah. And there's a fine line between the two. You have to understand what is, you know, how far you can go from that point of view without going overstepping the mark.
But the second in line to the throne's perspective was questioning whether a win-win mentality in children's sport, in which youngsters are protected from ever losing, would leave them struggling to cope with life as they grow up. So in other words, you can cuss at them right the way through, but then at some point they're going to have to enter the workplace. And in the workplace, there are going to be disappointments, because every so often, life throws in a curveball.
Oh, look, for sure. I mean, funny enough, I remember being 12, and at the time, Lee and Darren...
You surprised me. That was a long time ago.
It was a very long time ago. Lee and Darren were at professional clubs, and I made the conscious decision with my dad that I was going to play for a local team who weren't very good and enjoy my football. I did that for 3 years. And then after, it was at that point where I thought, you know what? I know what it means to win. We used to get absolutely hammered every week. And then all of a sudden we won one game and we started to win from then on. But I knew what it meant to win, and I knew what it meant to be a team and to look after my teammates. I think society has clearly changed an awful lot. And so have the challenges, and you know, general welfare of athletes has obviously been a very topical issue, quite rightly, more recently. But I still think everything that we're talking about comes back to the self-awareness of the children that are playing the game. Are they capable enough of being aware of what's going on around them? Do they have the emotional intelligence, for example, to make decisions based upon their own view? Or are they expecting to be spoon-fed that information? That's, for me, that's the argument that we should be looking at. Are we trying to tell them what to say and what to do on too many occasions without helping them realise their own ambitions based upon their own viewpoint? But again, that's not something that you can fix overnight. That is something that has happened over the last decade or two, and will probably take just as long to change. But fortunately now in football, we have the resources and the financial strength to do that and probably fast track it.
You'd have to overcome the family structure as well, wouldn't you?
But that's this, you know, we're not just talking about players here. If parents, mum or dad, aren't happy, son or daughter doesn't go to training. But then we're asking for the commitment from the parents. I remember when I was a child, my dad would come home from a double session at Royal Mail, drive my brother Lee to Ipswich. He'd then come back from that, drive down to Watford. My mum would then drive me to training and Elliot to training. If you look as a child, you want to be an athlete because that's what you see. I remember, you know, for example, I remember seeing the old Lucozade advert of John Barnes. You know, gets you first fast. I'd drink my Lucozade and I'd go out onto Larkfield Avenue and I'd run because I'm fast. Could you imagine children doing that nowadays? No. I don't feel like you've got the same demeanor, the same
it's not the same the connection, same is it?
Connection between athletes and society anymore. Because what I need to do is go and spend £200 on the latest boots.
Yeah.
And that's what's going to make me better. I just do you know what I mean? There doesn't seem to be that dream catching of wanting to be an athlete that there used to be anymore. And I think we need to let kids be kids. Yeah. That means the environment needs to be accepting that we all make mistakes and that the children know that if something goes wrong, don't worry about it, you learn from it.
Oh, I love this podcast.
But we're also very quick to pull people down, you know. So any little sort of like slither of success is seized upon and attacked, you know. So you'll always have an argument where, you know, sometimes I'll look at the comments on, you know, certain stories. And it's a good news story, but then you always get three or four people who are twisted.
Oh, you can't please everybody all the time.
But that's just what happens.
Yeah.
You know, nobody can turn around. You know it's right, but because it's not them or because people don't want to look in their mirror, they'll pull it down, you know?
I learned a new phrase the other day, FOMO. Fear of missing out. Yeah. I gather it's been around for quite some time, but it's a new one on
it's
me.
It's a new one on me, you know.
Yeah, fear of missing out. But that's another thing that comes out of all this social media, isn't it? Yeah. Constantly comparing ourselves as society, not just as sports people, to what other people are achieving with their lives.
But that goes back to societal impression, right? So my value is a perception of value based upon Brian's interpretation of me.
Mm.
That's damaging because what that means is that I downgrade my own self.
Yeah.
And my value, I can't decide on how I perceive myself because without you telling me, I'm an invaluable individual. I remember seeing and hearing a lot of stuff because you do when you're a group of four boys in a football environment for a very long time. And as Brian said, it's very difficult because you have the coaches who have always done something one way and therefore you've had that transition towards, you know, people like Tony coming into the industry. You know, I remember the days where you'd go, if you had a bad match on a weekend, you go in on a Monday and you know you're going to run and you're going to run and you're going to run because that's how you solve it. Things change. But unfortunately, that FOMO element is what's driving a lot of bad habits in the industry because we're being sold that dream. We're being sold that golden ticket. And if you don't do this, you won't get that.
As I said, that this was a new phrase on me. There are a couple of younger people in the room and they tutted. Like I should have known.
Yeah, that's probably well out of date by now or something. And
yeah, probably there'll be something else, won't there? Well out of date and running out of time. Let's have our latest excerpt from Tony Strudwick.
I'm going to ask you a really straightforward down the line question. How hard do you think we should push our athletes? What are the tolerances and the barometers that you would use to assess that?
Well, again, I think, first and foremost, I mean, I talk about pushing the boundaries of human performance because, you know, I've worked with athletes and the top athletes, and I do feel that the ones that get to the top are very unique individuals, physically and mentally, and the resilience that's required to get to that level and stay at there. I think the human form is capable of really pushing the boundaries. The flip side of that, Mark, is that I'm also aware that, you know, we have a mantra that you respect the athlete first and foremost. You do no harm physically and mentally, but you do something. So when you say how hard we should push them, it may well be that I think it should be the athlete that really dictates that, how far that they can push themselves. Our job as sports science is to support the athlete along the way, to monitor and record and put in place a system to say, right, this is where the athlete's at and this is the kind of progress or scaffold they're challenging up. So that's the role of the sports scientist, is to monitor and record. And I think that's really important. But invariably, I think it's about seeing where the athlete can take themselves. The flip side of that is that I don't think we should put restrictions on athletes. I don't think we should be saying, right, they can't do this, or it's a red flag or culture, or there's a ceiling to this athlete's performance. I think it should be driven by what they can achieve rather than what they can't achieve.
By the same token, though, particularly if you're in a solo sport where you're going out alone, you are going to push and push and push, and you've got these cycles towards Olympics, and people can see their opportunity disappearing if they don't make it at this particular Olympics.
Yeah.
You know, you are going to push yourself as hard as possible, perhaps more than you should.
Yeah, and I think there's really a fine balance to be had, Mark, and I think, you know, elite sport by its very nature, it can be quite extreme and it can be quite brutal. I think, you know, to get to the very, very top, it's highly challenging. And, you know, sometimes that comes at a cost, whether it's a physical cost, whether it's a psychological cost, whether it's an emotional stroke relationship cost. And that happens with everybody in elite sport, because you're so totally absorbed in sport and you're so totally absorbed in getting to the top and pushing yourself that, you know, sometimes that lack of awareness of what's going on outside and you know, the potential negative effects of pushing yourself so hard for so long. And again, that's why it's so important to have these support mechanisms in place from a sports science perspective and, you know, from a player care perspective, to ensure that, you know, we're there to support the athlete on their journey, Mark. And I think that's really important, that athletes need that level of support. And they need that kind of safety net, or that safety valve where we can add perspective and we can try and guide them through their athlete process.
We're heading towards a mental health epidemic as the world, let alone as this country. Do you think mental health provision should be a natural shoe into elite sport as well? That there should be people available at all times, but almost being offered rather than when people ask for it?
Absolutely. I think it's great over the last couple of years in professional football anyways, that the raised awareness of ex-players coming out and saying that actually we stripped beneath this kind of this macho image of what football is about, is that, you know, mental health is a real issue, and we know it's a real issue in our sport. So my opinion would be, Mark, that these kind of support mechanisms and these networks of support are in place, and I think it's got to be made aware to the players and the athletes, not just footballers, but just all athletes in general. And I think the other thing around it is that we've got to have people with the right skill sets to be able to deliver that. You know, player care is here. I mean, player care, and, you know, there are a lot of player care models in place, but I would like to see that kind of player care system a little bit more governed. Okay, what does the head of player care look like? What would you need as someone from a head of player care? You'd want the skill set, mate, potentially, of somebody that can come in who's got a psychological background, maybe a counselling background, maybe an education background. So having a team around the players with the right skills. You know, it's not about player care. Is not, you know, providing a concierge service to footballers to go out and, you know, set up bank accounts and so on and so forth. We come on to that in a minute, because that's another kind of issue. Player care is actually making sure that we facilitate processes and put processes in place that players are aware of what's available to help support them as athletes, and to create independent learners, independent thinkers, and people with the right life skills to be successful, not just in their sport, but outside of it as well.
So to that end, EY are bang on the money with their personal performance program, and particularly offering that element of independence as well.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the EY development plan, it is about developing, we had a really good young sort of member of staff that joined Manchester United, Chris McCready, and he came in and he did some really great talks about having support. So as an individual athlete, you've got more legs. You've not just got one central leg on the table that's professional football. You've got other legs of support around, because when one goes, you've got others to fall back on. And Chris was very much, and I love that concept of building skills outside of just being a footballer, building life skills, building coping skills, building transitional skills, awareness, all these kind of these behaviors or these winning behaviors, not just athletes need, but other individuals that are successful in life, they have these kind of winning behaviors and these kind of support mechanisms in place that they can tap into.
So much we could pick out of there, Brian, but do you have conversations with former teammates and they're more forthcoming about their emotional state back in the day? In other words, in your era, it was bottle it all up, don't let your guard down. But now people are happy to share what they were going through at the time.
I'm not sure people are happy to share.
Happy was probably the wrong word, but you take the inference of what I'm saying.
I think they'd be happier to discuss it if it's something that they know they can discuss with somebody who's been through it as well. You know, to get to the top as an athlete, you have to almost try and make yourself invincible, you know, not have any chinks in your armour. And so it's like holding your breath for as long as you can. So from that point of view, it is perhaps still quite difficult. And I suppose it's only in a forum where you know people understand what you might have been through that people will feel comfortable. And it's, you know, yeah.
So it's a very valid point, Brian. Mark Hunter and I have been delivering face-to-face workshops more recently in sport, specifically looking at the transition of careers while you're an active athlete and beyond. And clearly we share our own experiences. So, you know, for me, a slightly morbid one, having now, you know, been on the receiving end of two cardiac surgeries and had numerous other surgeries during my time. And Mark shares his experiences around the challenges of Olympic cycles and, you know, the state of depressions that can follow based upon your performance and support networks around you. And the interaction we've received from the audience has been overwhelming, because one of the common factors has been you understand what it means. You've either been through that, or you speak in a way that we can understand and therefore we can communicate with, knowing that this is a safe space. I think, you know, as I mentioned, you know, we're now qualified mental health first aiders because it's a very vital point of the development cycle for any person in any industry. But we keep forgetting about the managers, the coaches. This type of thing doesn't just impact players. You know, it also impacts the coaches and the people that work around the organisation. Quite often, especially when Brian just finished playing, you'd often see players going from playing to coaching quite quickly. And yet they're meant to be in a position of influence and understanding emotionally on how to safeguard 25, 30, 40 players. That's unrealistic. And so we need to perhaps look at what we're doing, not only for athletes while they're competing, but also for the coaches that are facilitating the athletes, for the parents as well, because, you know, their son or daughter, all of a sudden, I remember thinking the same, where you go from being, you know, this is a fun sport, this is a hobby, to this is now my job. And at times what you normally get then is a bit of a divide between the family and the son or daughter, because straight away, when you're younger, you think, well, they don't understand me now because you don't know this. And so how can we fill that void as a family unit? But then how can we also ensure that there's a safe environment between coaches and players so that you can communicate in a way that also isn't going to be detrimental towards you being picked on a weekend?
Can I ask you, we talk about support networks and, you know, mental health first aid, but every year that goes past, there's more and more ex-players. They're going to give longer and longer. Who's in place for somebody of your generation? Who would you turn to if you started to struggle now? Would you have to go completely private on that, or is there anybody you could turn to within the game who you feel might owe you?
Well, that's a good question. Well, there are box ticking exercises, so there's availability. But actually getting out there and understanding is a different issue altogether. I think if you talk about what players do or what ex-players do, I think it's usually discussions with others who have been through certain things. It's your, you know, that's your safe environment, you know.
So it's peer experiences.
Peer experiences. You know, this is what we used to do. How's so-and-so? Oh, he's struggling or what? Oh, maybe I'll give him a ring or whatever. Because it's very, you know, we are sort of like, we're built up to be these infallible people. And it's like what happens when you're outside. You go out, you smile, everybody knows who you are. And then you get in and you get home and you like shut the door. It's like, you know, it's almost like, well, you know, if only they knew some of the things that were going on in the background.
But at this point as well is that it's we concentrate on the Premier League, but everybody that commits to any sector, any job, has a demand, whether that's mental health support or self-development. You know, we've been talking about football as a business. Therefore, you need a scalable model that makes you accessible to everybody that's involved in that life cycle. It's very hard for the PFA to do that for one reason or another. And that's where we would like to try and contribute to this space, to give them the scalability to meet demand, no matter what level you play at. You know, I didn't play in the Premier League. My brothers have. Was there a difference in the services that I was provided with? Of course there was. But there doesn't have to be. Because like we've spoken about previously, Mark, on our other podcast, you know, Tanny Gray Thompson referred to the fact that, and you know, she's yet to come to meet an athlete that has gone to an Olympic Games to fail. And it's the same for footballers. If you're playing at League Two, it's not because you want to be playing at League Two. No. You want to be playing in the Premier League.
Doing the best you can.
Absolutely. Yeah. And therefore, we need to do the best we can for them in return.
Yeah. We've got to wrap things up. Before we do, let's hear from our final excerpt of Tony Strudwick.
Do you think with the elite football clubs, there should be something in place to sort of monitor them when they do move on? I know they might have another 5-6 years after you, but do you think football clubs have a duty of responsibility to players just to check in on them and see if they're okay, if they have made a major contribution to the club's history?
Yeah, I do. I think it's a collective, it's a holistic process. It's not just... You know, that responsibility doesn't just sit with the football clubs, Mark, although I think they're a key stakeholder, in that there are other stakeholders like agents, like governing bodies, and you know, people in roles that really are making sure that they're connecting and overseeing. And it's not just the ones that the really incredibly successful ones, because, you know, they're not just the ones that, you know, they've got accessibility potentially from a resource perspective. We're also talking about young 19, 20, 21 year olds that are not going to be successful and have the trappings that came with a 10, 15 year career. So they need help as well. And yeah, and I've got to say, and you know, my previous club, Manchester United, you know, the welfare officer and education guy, they were brilliant at that, brilliant at connecting with the kids, and you know, trying to get them, you know, outside into whether it be US colleges or, you know, careers beyond that. But yeah, coming back to it, the whole essence of the question, yeah, there should be one person that's making sure that, you know, they're doing follow-ups and checks and along the way, because, you know, if you're not careful, people will fall out of your radar, and somebody's got to be the connector to bring them back in that radar.
Because we do know if somebody does pass on, if there is a disaster, sure as heck the club get involved at that point and celebrate that individual's life. It just seems there should be a link that goes through that process and provides a little bit of prevention that one or two of the more challenged don't end up in the difficulties that they can end up in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that has to happen. And again, you're right, Mark. It shouldn't just happen right at the last moment. That should be something that's really inbuilt from, you know, as soon as you sign professionally with a football club or an organisation with a PFA or the Premier League, is that once you're in that system, then you should now be, you know, be treated as an individual that's supported right along your journey.
Because there's enough money in football, Tony, for everybody to have a passport, if you like, that you're monitored, particularly electronically, and that somebody's touching base with you every so often.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a bit like the old kind of, you know, the careers advice officer in your schools years ago, is that, you know, there was good, bad and different ones, but invariably but at least it was somebody that you could go to for advice. And I think the part of the, you know, and I do feel for clubs in one respect. I mean, take the resources out of it, because there's no excuse for any player that's been in the system in this country now to not have enough resources and enough support to help them be successful for the rest of their careers. So the resources are there, but the other problem, you know, and it's not an excuse, but it is a fast-paced environment as well. I mean, the whole, you know, it's become... The whole environment, the whole industry's became quick in, quick out. And I think that's the other thing, is that, you know, where years ago, if you'd have sort of been at a club for many years and there's a community feel and a cultural piece behind it, is that you can, you know, you can bring them back at certain events. And I think that club feel, that one club culture, is a lot easier to manage. But now it's so quick, it can be difficult. But that's not an excuse. It should still happen, in my opinion.
I do realise I've set clubs, they're rather a large task. I mean, because as I said to Brian previously, you know, every year the alumni from each club just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It would be a huge pot to try and maintain, to give all that responsibility to the clubs to say, you know, you've played, this player has played for you, so you need to look after them.
But that's where the point comes around, giving them the tools to make better decisions while they're active in the organisation, so that it becomes self-sustaining. You know, there is the argument around how long do we look after a player for when they've left the club. But if we're doing more for them while they're in the business, while they're in the club, we know that they will have that capability of doing things with a better interpretation. The long-term impact, I think, will be there to be seen. But at least then we're not having to be reactive like we currently are. And of course, we're constantly reading about the ramifications of such events.
Here's your problem at the top end, right? All those guys that are earning absolute fortunes will primarily be thinking with a financial head on, and they'll be thinking they won't have a problem. Yeah. It's only once they've quit the game, had their 6 months, year, 18 months lying on a beach, drinking as much beer as they want to, doing whatever they want to do, that they suddenly realise they're still very young people with maybe, well, certainly over half their life left, hopefully, in which they've got to sustain themselves, in which they've got to find a purpose and identity for decades and decades and decades.
But the danger on that though, Mark, as well, sorry, Brian, is that it doesn't matter how much money you earn. For example, I spoke to an ex-athlete who's got 4 degrees. They said to me quite openly, this is the first time in 6 years they've understood their purpose as a person. Because while academic qualifications are supportive and they're very important, depending on what vocation you choose next, and money clearly gives you opportunity and gives you choice, they are not preventative actions against the cliff edge traumas that especially the footballers that we're speaking about currently are facing. And so without that missing link, without that self-development, self-awareness, we're still going to be reading about athletes falling over.
Brian, you've spoken to us very openly. I mean, can I ask you another couple of quite honest questions? I mean, do you hark back a lot? Do you sometimes think, I just wish I could rewind the clock 20 years and still be that gladiator that you've spoken of?
Look, I mean, I watch and you think that's those nights, you know, smell the air, the grass, the, you know, the atmosphere and you know, being in front of the crowd, you know, scoring. Of course, you know, you never lose that. And that's those are the kind of highs that you get, you know. So, of course, there's and the conversely, the lows are when you haven't got anything like that anymore. So retraining, preparing people for the transition is very important. And it's, I think it's underplayed at the moment. You know, athletes need to be told that they have vast experiences and vast skill sets that can be used in businesses, whether it's creating a team, for example, that has a siege mentality to improve the efficiency of performance, for example. You know, that's whatever. You know, I managed and what I found is that, you know, you have to make the environment a good environment for people to come to work in. And if you do that, they'll thrive. You know, there are small tricks that doesn't matter whether it's football, banking, whatever, that it's the same, you know, and we can tap into that.
And I think, you know, athletes need to realise and be told this constantly. There is a euphoria beyond sport. You know, when you have to hang up your boots or your gloves, the world doesn't end. In fact, it just begins. And, you know, there needs to be more positivity around transition. But again, we need to allow them to see the full picture and to make out that image on their own interpretation, not for somebody else to tell them what it looks like.
Scott, thanks as always. Brian, lovely to see you. Thanks for coming to join us. Thanks also to Tony Strudwick and to Louis Sahar. And thank you to you for listening to this episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears. Much more to come in terms of both topics and a huge range of athletes and sports people in coming episodes. For more information about the programme, please visit our website. That's ey.com/UK/personal-performance-programme. This podcast and future podcasts in the Blood, Sweat and Fears series will be be available on iTunes and via the EY website by visiting ey.com/UK/PAS/podcast. I'm Mark Clement, brought to you by EY, building a better working world. Thanks for listening to the latest episode of Blood, Sweat and Fears, the ultimate podcast with a focus on athlete experiences, readiness and preparation for life in and out of sport. Goodbye.